We need to have a unit or beat it so that
we can start. Yeah. So here's the thing. I've had some various exclusive cookies, like, you know, themed cookies that I had wanted to bring with me and completely forgot. So I was just going to be like, oh, well, there it is. But when I stopped at 7-Eleven to get something to drink for the movie, I saw these here and I thought, what better pairs with D&D than Doritos?
Wait. I want to know what it was supposed to be. Are we allowed to know?
I will probably try it. If we do it soon enough, I will bring it with me the next time.
I'm so pissed. Mystery. You should have just said this was the thing.
This is the thing. I didn't say anything else. What the fuck are you talking about?
So what are these?
These are Doritos Late Night Hot Honey Pizza flavored chips. I've never...
Okay,
they're making shit up.
Yeah,
to
be fair, so here's the
It's supposed to be like you're eating like cold pizza from the fridge.
Cold pizza with hot honey on it.
Yeah.
And so like that, I admit, is a flavor, but then you're also grafting onto a Dorito, of course, which is its own other thing. It's like now we've sinned against God. But here we go. I'll throw these out because I probably will not finish
When I was
these.
Reading the back of that and saw all the late night shit, I was like, oh my God, is this like a Jimmy Fallon thing?
Yes, this is Jimmy Fallon's favorite flavor. These look very dusty. Okay.
Oh, I don't think I like this.
That certainly feels like what science would tell you hot honey pizza tastes like.
Okay. I'm going to try to say this, and I'm not sure if this is going to make sense. I taste pizza.
Yeah.
I taste Dorito.
Yeah.
I taste hot honey, but it's like I'm tasting them all entirely separate.
I completely agree with you. It's like there's nothing about this that's melding them together. They're all individual flavors somehow. Not in a way that's like fun or interesting. In a way that's like, this simply cannot work as a
concept.
It
is literally like they somehow intermixed, you know, whatever dust this is to make it taste this way, and yet the flavors do not overlap.
It's so weird.
It feels like... To me, it just kind of feels like you inelegantly sprayed Italian seasoning over a Dorito.
Yeah, there's some of that in there for sure.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like a really, like, I'm just eating just like raw seasoning.
And when almost
it's
an
like oregano or something, just pretty much.
And then almost an entire beat after you've swallowed, then it's like, ooh, here's just like a hint of heat.
Right, yeah, exactly. Which is interesting in theory that like the heat kicks in at the end. Like, there, I can envision a world where that works as something.
Here's the thing. I love hot honey on pizza.
I do too.
I do not love this.
No, these remind me, of like pizza combos a little bit. In the same artificial
pizza
sense.
Pizza combos are way better.
But I agree the pizza combos are, in fact, better. I like pizza combos. These are weird.
For as powdery and as, just like what you were saying, it does just feel like you're eating like just like a spoonful of herbs.
Yeah.
I feel like I can also just taste...
Make the nose thing go down?
I feel like I can almost... I feel like I can also taste...
That's the sneak ultimate version. A spoonful of herbs make the medicine come up.
I can taste also unseasoned tortilla chip.
Yeah.
Which is so weird.
Yeah.
How?
Yeah, I know, right? You would think...
It's like it's separate. It's like...
Like, as soon as you put it in your as soon as you put it into your mouth, it separates up.
Instead of, like, creating a new chemical, it unbinds everything.
Right, it's great.
And then parts.
It's like, they didn't realize that, like, human saliva was, like, a super solvent for this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, this is straight up bad.
Nah,
I'm so glad I didn't buy a large bag of these.
This is 1,000% a beat it.
Yeah.
I will not have any
No, thank you. Yeah, no, I'm going to just throw these out, I think, because I'm not taking them home, and I will not be eating anymore.
Wow. I don't think we've had... of Why Did We Watch This, the podcast where three friends sit down with a troubled movie, a themed cocktail, and then talk about what worked, what didn't, and how they would fix it. But this is a mini episode, and I am Chris Revell.
I am Brendan Drischler.
And I am Lee Delahanty.
And we are coming here to announce that in 2 weeks, we are going to be doing the Year 2000's Dungeons and Dragons.
Yep. No colon, no subtitles.
Just that.
Dungeons and Dragons, baby.
This is yet another bad one.
Yep.
And boy, is it really, really, really bad.
Yeah, kind of a notoriously bad movie. Again, from 2000, directed by Courtney Solomon, starring Justin Whalen, Marlon Wayans, Thor Birch, and, of course, Jeremy's Iron.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy Irons is... And your buddy, Richard Curtis.
Oh, yeah, Dickie O'Brien. No, not Richard Curtis. Not noted writer-director Richard Curtis.
Whoops. Richard
O'Brien.
Which
would be very interesting, too.
That would be very funny.
Yes. Richard Curtis.
Especially if he had the same earring.
Yes, playing the same part, exactly the same.
I am honestly extremely excited to just go in on this movie with you two, just because it is like an all-time classic bad bomb of a movie.
Unquestionably. And of course, we have to contrast it with
a delicious drink.
Yes. The drink that we'll be making for Dungeons and Dragons is called Rule for Sobriety. It is 1.5 ounces of tequila, half an ounce of honey whiskey, 1 ounce of lime juice, and 1 ounce of smoked blackberry puree. To make the blackberry puree, smoke the blackberries for 15 minutes. Put the smoked blackberries in a food processor. Add 1 tablespoon of sugar and puree until combined. Strain the puree and store it in a refrigerator for up to 1 week. To make the cocktail itself, you add the tequila, the honey whiskey, the lime juice, and the blackberry puree to a shaker with ice. Shake until chilled and strain into a glass over ice. It's smoky like a dragon and berries like the thing that people eat in these games, maybe? Yeah, I don't know. Sure.
Sure.
Why not?
There's that druid spell, Goodberry.
Yeah, everyone. Yeah, Goodberry. Welcome to Goodberry.
It's me.
Home of the Goodberry.
Can't wait to drink that. Can't wait to destroy this movie together. On the complete opposite side of the coin,
yes,
we got together to watch a far superior film, this being Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, which came out in...
2023.
Yep.
2023.
Yes, directed by John Francis Daley and Jonathan Goldstein.
And written by the same, I believe.
Written by the same, yes.
And
also with a Michael Giglio, who co-wrote with them, from a story by Chris McKay and Michael Giglio.
Yes.
So, yes.
And then we had, I mean, there's a bunch of people in it, but like Chris Pine, Michelle Rodriguez, Sophia Lillis,
yeah,
Justice Smith. Yeah. Can I go all the way?
Go all the way.
one big one you haven't done.
Yeah, I know. And his name is on the tip of my tongue.
Rhymes with slew.
Slew rhymes with slew slant.
Hugh Grant. Chase Infinity before one battle after another made her super famous.
Chase Infinity? Oh, is she the
she's
kid?
The daughter, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Huh? I didn't realize it was her.
Ren, what's his name?
René Jean Page.
René Jean Page.
René Jean Page.
In a very fun role.
Yes.
And also a really fun cameo from Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
I think that's it, right? Is it, did I miss any?
You got the good ones.
Are you sure the Chase Infinity is in this?
Pretty sure.
Are you sure that it's not an actor named Chloe Coleman as Kira, who is not Chase Infinity?
Okay, fine. I should have looked it up before.
Probably, but you seem so confident, and I just hadn't looked at all, that I assumed you might have been right.
It was the confidence of the unknown.
That's, ain't it the truth? Ain't it the truth?
So, just to kind of, you know, put an umbrella over our conversation, we were going to lean on Lee to give us a kicky little summary.
Abridged.
Sure. Abridge it.
This movie centers on four characters, but we'll start with Ed and Edgin Darvis, played by Chris Pine. And Holga, played by Michelle Rodriguez.
Yes.
They are two, let's call them adventurers, who have been imprisoned. And at the start of the movie, they are sort of up for pardon, and they sort of escape sort of unnecessarily because it turns out they were going to be allowed to be pardoned anyway. During the pardon, we kind of learn their backstory of how Ed was a Harper, which is like a nice order of spies that do good and all that good stuff.
Kind of a bunch of Robin Hoods.
Robin Hood, yeah, like spies and messengers, but ran afoul of some red wizards who didn't like that he took one of them in. So they came down and killed his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He has a wife, and his child is still alive, but the wife is dead. And so he kind of had like a spiral for a while before he met Holga, and they kind of like raised her together. And then the two of them became small time thieves and teamed up with Hugh Grant, who plays Forge, a con artist, and Justice Smith, who plays
Simon,
Almer, who's like a sorcerer. And the four of them, you know, live a life of thieving up until they take this, you know, one last job, quote unquote, where the pull for Ed was that he could get this tablet that would allow him to resurrect his wife, which was something, you know, we thought was like, oh, I'm going to bring back Kira's mom.
Mm-hmm.
So they leave Kira at home and they go to do it. But this is how they end up getting caught because it kind of goes awry.
But there is also, it's important to note.
Yes, there's Sofina.
Yes.
The person who brings in this job is a wizard by the name of Sofina.
Right.
Who
casts a spell that we won't go into, but basically
it's time stuff. Yeah.
Right. She gets, yeah, I know. She gets out, Hugh Grant gets out, the others all effectively
get captured. The only people that get caught are end up being Holga and
right, right.
Everyone else sort of manages to get out of the time stop
right.
Before it catches them. So that kind of brings us back up to present, with them escaping and knowing that Ed had told Forge that, you know, to look after Kira.
Right, and to keep the tablet safe.
He gives them the tablet. So the first thing to do is go there, only to find out that Forge, a con man, has been conning them the whole time mm-hmm. and has spent the past several years while they're in prison sort of poisoning his daughter's mind by saying, like, oh, your father wanted to do this job for the Tablet of Riches, which gives you riches.
Right.
And also, he's lying about getting pardoned. He's getting out of jail. And so her Kira's really distrustful, and it turns out that in the interim years of their imprisonment, Forge has sort of, like, conned his way into being the Lord of Neverwinter with the wizard Sofina as his, like, primary aide. So after Kira sort of leaves in a huff because she's not really trusting them, Sofina tries to have Ed and Holga killed, which is unsuccessful because Holga's such a badass.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them resolve to essentially, like, steal the tablet from the vault.
And rescue Kira.
So to do that, they have to, like, form a team and make a plan and all that good stuff. So that they meet up with Simon, who is sort of doing small-time magic. Still kind of this, like, inept, half-inept, like, wild sorcerer.
Mm-hmm.
Simon recommends that they seek the help of this druid tiefling, who's really good, by the name of Doric, who is part of the Emerald Enclave, which is, like, you know, this group of, like, woodsy, druidy people who live in the woods. They're being threatened by Neverwinter soldiers.
Primarily elves.
Primarily elves, yeah. So they go find Doric and try to convince her with... I forget how they get her on their side, because she doesn't like humans. I think it's because...
I believe it's just that her land is, like, yeah. under threat, so she...
Yeah, and she hates that, and Neverwinter's kind of responsible yeah. for some of the
things. When she's interested in taking a swipe at Forge.
Yeah. Yeah. Forge is kind of responsible for some of the destruction that's happening. So yeah, they get the two of them. The next thing I have to do is form a plan. Doric finds out from her initial spying that the vault is sealed with magical protections, something that she calls, like, Mordekainen's shield or something. Which Simon recognizes as, like, an incredibly powerful spell that would require, like, magic beyond his own ability, or a cool helm called the Helm of Disjunction, which no one knows where it is, except someone knows where it is.
Yeah.
Like, it was part of this big famous battle that Holga's ancestors or, like, family or tribe fought to protect. And she's like, well, they're all dead now, and you'd have to speak with the dead. And Simon's like, oh, well, I can speak with the dead. So off they go to the graveyard, and they find the next clue from one of many corpses they speak to, that the helm was ultimately taken by a Thayan wizard known as...
Thayan Paladin.
They don't describe it. They just say Thayan man known as Zenk.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of triggers Egan, who has bad blood with the Thayans. He kind of thinks that all Thayans are bad, but is convinced that they need to talk to this guy because he's their only lead on the Helm of Disjunction. So they find out where he's currently headquartered and, you know, go talk to him. Once they tell him that... am I losing something here? Because do they know about the Red Wizards being involved yet?
No.
He's the one who tells them that, right? Because, well, I don't know if they know that he tells them his own backstory involving Red Wizards, right?
But doesn't Doric tell them? Because she, before that point, saw
She knows Sofina during the spying. She has to convince Zenk to allow them to see the helm.
Sure.
And Doric is the first person to notice that Sofina, still very spooky wizard.
Right, but she's dressed in black there, but it turns out her real color is red.
Her real color is red. She's pretending to be, like...
A spooky lady.
A normal spooky wizard, right. but it turns out
she's a very bad spooky wizard.
Yeah. So, Doric happens to know this, that she's, by this point, that they know that she's a Thane wizard. So, that's how they get Zenk on side, is that Doric says... He doesn't want to show them where the helm is because he's obviously trying to keep it safe.
Right.
And then Doric is like, well, we know that Forge is working with a Thane wizard. And Zenk is like, okay, let's talk. And so he takes them into his little secret headquarters, which is the Harper's headquarters. And he kind of looks at Edgar pointingly and is like, well, nice to see you here, huh? Which indicates that he seems to have, like, working relationships with the Harpers. And he says that he's been keeping the helm in the Underdark, which is, like, kind of a crazy place to keep it because it's so dangerous. And he's like, well, that's why I keep it there, because nobody can get it. And so he agrees to take them there, provided that Ed swears that when they steal from the vault, that all the riches will go to all of the people of Neverwinter. And he sort of swears on the book of the Harpers or whatever.
The Not Bible.
Yes, the Not Bible.
So they go to the Underdark. It's very dark and very scary, and there's a very large, corpulent dragon. They get that.
He's my favorite.
Yeah. And they discover along the way that this walking stick that Holga took from her ex-husband is actually a super crazy, like, portal staff. That is super useful both in the Underdark and later on in the movie. And they also obtain the Helm of Disjunction. The next problem being that Simon has to attune to the Helm of Disjunction, which is not as easy as it sounds, as it's sort of like a test of his, like, magical prowess, and he keeps failing it. And so they agree that they're going to keep going ultimately, but Edgar has formed all of these, like, alternate plans, and one of these alternate plans involves putting something into the vault that they can use to portal into the vault.
Right. If they place a portal on this item the item goes into the vault, they can theoretically open a new portal and travel from their portal to the portal on the item inside the vault.
So they buy a painting. They put, like, the portals in the, like,
blank. Behind the painting.
Yeah.
They put the painting back on. Well, they have to do that inside the thing, actually. So they buy this painting first. Then they get, like, all this glue. It's a very convoluted plan, but it's very clever. And they, like, stick it to the underside of the carriage, portal into the carriage from there. Which is, like, they open the portal and it's wood, but they, like, open the wood first and they get it. And ultimately, they manage to, like, smuggle this painting into a carriage without anyone knowing.
Right.
Leave the portal open inside the painting, put the painting back on it, and then sneak back out of the carriage. So that this painting with a portal under it, like a half open, you know, one-sided portal, is just, like, in the vault.
Right.
Unfortunately, when that painting enters the vault, it falls face down. So that when they open the portal, it's just, like, stone. Wood. Like, floor. Right. And so two sort of subplans form where Simon is going to frantically try to attune with the helmet one more time. And Doric is going to try to chip away at the stone underneath enough that she can create, like, a tiny hole that she can wild shape into a worm to sneak under.
Right. Did we establish that Doric can shapeshift into animals? Is that something?
Doric is a druid.
Yeah, okay.
For non-D&D players, when I say druid, she shapeshifts.
Yes. Yeah.
She wild shapes into different animals. So those things each happen to go off successfully. Mm-hmm. However, Doric goes into the vault.
Right.
Only to find out that she's not in the vault. She's, like, in some place under the arena where the High Sun Games is happening, which is this, like, gladiatorial
stadium
sort of stadium where a bunch of people are about to be subjected to, like, a series of incredibly dangerous monsters and encounters and puzzles.
Yeah, like gladiatorial challenges.
Yeah,
sort of,
where they're gonna die.
Right.
Ultimately.
Right.
And all of the treasure is. She has time to see all of it sort of being hauled out onto, like, a dock nearby before she's knocked out. Meanwhile, outside the vault, Simon attunes to the vault. Holga shows up to join them. They go inside the vault. The vault is empty, and there's nothing in it. It turns out that the treasure was never in the vault. The treasure is being taken out of the city on a boat. And the two of them are quickly caught in these, like, tentacles that Sofina summons up. Doric is knocked out.
Yes.
Edgar, meanwhile, is rushing to go get his daughter, and he finds her. Or so he thinks. Gives, like, a heartwarming speech. Like, I need you to believe me. I was going to come back for you. And then she sort of laughs in a laugh that becomes increasingly more horrific and then turns into Sofina. And he also gets tentacle trapped. Then the four of them wake up inside the High Sun Games as competitors.
Well, also, it should be Hugh Grant is like, I'm going to kill you right now.
Yes.
Chris Pine says, like, no, put us in the games. And Sofina's like, I agree, put them in the games. So it's like, there is sort of like, why does she want all these people in the games, actually?
Yes,
like, why would she rather have them there and not just kill them now?
Yeah.
Which they mention.
They end up in the games. And Hugh Grant is going to take Kira and all the treasure out of the city. And she kind of implies that it's her city now as he's
Sofina
like,
implies that
Sofina,
it's her city, yes.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in the games, now they have to sort of survive again in this, like, ever-changing labyrinth. And they quickly realize that, like, to keep surviving the challenges is going to be pointless because there's
just
going to be more and more challenges. Yeah. But they notice that things keep, like, coming up and out of the ground. And in one of these challenges, like, one of these, like, bits of the maze, there's a gelatinous cube, which is, like, it's, like, slowly acid bubbling away at you, but you're not dead instantly. And Doric convinces them all to like leap into it at the same time right before it gets shunted back down below. So they all end up in the basement below. And then she like is able to get out as a snake and then pull them all out. And now they're successfully like underneath the arena and they're able to like get back on the boat. They're able to very quickly subdue Hugh Grant because Hugh Grant's a fop.
Yeah. Not really a villain.
Yeah, he's kind of by himself and there's really not much he can do. And they begin to like sail away with all of this treasure and Kira and
Orinoco flow.
And then behind them, they just kind of realize that like hell is unleashing over the
right. There arena. Are tendrilly clouds congregating above the stadium, which we as viewers and they also know corresponds to what Regé Jean Page told us about how when he was a kid, a group of red wizards
basically turned everyone into zombies.
Right. One in particular who we know that Safina has allied herself with because we see her speaking with them, basically like turned a whole group of people into zombies just because like for this spell to work, you need to chunk of people in proximity to each other. So we see, oh no, that's what she's doing. Yeah. She's going to turn every human in the stadium into her zombies.
And so she's, you know, they're all kind of like, oh, well, shit. And they have to, they just, you know, without much thinking, they just sort of turn the boat around and decide they have to go save the day. They have this boat full of treasure and they have the staff and like, they realize that they have to get all the people out. And there's this like huge blimp over the city with Hugh Grant's fucking face all over it. And he's like, oh, I guess I'll do what Zenk said after all, and like starts this like portal that comes out of Hugh Grant's mouth and then into the bottom of the boat so that all the treasure is like
the Hugh Grant balloon mouth.
Yes, the Hugh Grant balloon mouth. So that all of the treasure starts like funneling out of the boat, it like out of the mouth.
Of the balloon, like out of the, from the boat from into the boat, balloon.
Into the balloon, out of the mouth. So it starts to fly out of the arena and all of the people start to see this and are like, oh, it's the gift.
Treasure,
treasure, Fox gave us a gift.
And yeah, like, let's leave the arena and go grab treasure. And so people's like, damn it.
So she starts like, she starts to like summon this horrific red cloud that turns people into zombies and she looks around and there's like nobody left. Right. She's like, and they just kind of lie in wait outside the arena and have this big all-out brawl of magic and fighting and they ultimately...
And chicanery.
Yeah. And they do win.
Mm-hmm.
It's very exciting and very well done.
Mm-hmm.
But Holga, unfortunately, is struck by a Red Wizard's Blade, which we learn from when Ed's wife died, is a blade that does not allow you to be... Like, it's a healed. Poison that cannot be healed. Right. And you
magic
cannot
does
be
not work.
Resurrected from.
Unless...
Unless you have the legendary tablet of resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, he sort of brings it out between... himself and his daughter, and they kind of look at each other, and you know, there's a moment of realizing that like Holga is the one that's been Kira's mother,
effectively,
and they're, like, right. they're the one that are like the family rather than this the Kira.
Right, and I think it's also just a quick thing to note is that Regé Jean Page earlier said something about how like, well, you know, death is not really like death in the way you think of it. Like it's sort of a new life, and if you like wake her back up into this life, you're depriving her of like the where she exists now currently, and so. You know, also to be thrown in there, Chris Pine has some assurance that, like, his wife has moved on to something else in some capacity.
There's also some symbolism with, like, a dragonfly.
Yes.
Where he remembers, like, this dragonfly and that his wife and I had to, his wife and he had to, like, chase out of the house. And he kind of sees it throughout and he's, like, he, like, sort of lets it fly away, symbolically saying, like, it's fine to let her go now. And they use the tablet to resurrect Holga. And that's the end of the movie.
Yep, it basically sets them up to like go have another adventure because they know that what's the
Zaztam?
Yeah, Zaztam. They're like Zaztam is probably going to come for us, so like we'll be ready for him if he does.
Yeah,
and then no sequel
and sets up for a sequel because it did not make enough money to justify a sequel.
Yeah, bummer. This is the forever story of movies. Now they make money, but not quite enough money.
You've made money, but have you made enough money? Actually, I'm curious. It was a budget of 150. Well, this didn't. It was a budget of 150. Box office was 208. So like, it truly did not make enough money. There it is, though.
That's a bummer.
Yeah,
I have a lot of affection for this movie. I think it's the closest we have come yet to making a good D&D movie. And I've watched quite a few like made for TV garbagios in my time. I really enjoy this movie a lot.
Yeah. So you two have seen this movie before. Yeah. I had never seen this before. Did you see it in theaters, both of you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I had known it by reputation. I had known it was supposed to be like a fun movie. And so I thought, you know, it would be a good counterpoint to the movie we'll be talking about in 2 weeks. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed this movie. Well, like, there's get it out of the way. Might as well. I had a good time. I thought it was very entertaining. I thought everyone was very good. I think it pretty effectively captured the tone of playing a game of D&D, which is not something I have a lot of experience with, but nonetheless it does. I think it strikes a good balance between being straightforward and being a little more tongue-in-cheek, which I was kind of worried going into it that it was going to be. So I guess here's a question that I have kind of about D&D in general, and I think I know the answer to this, but I just want to make sure. So D&D basically can be as serious as you want it to be, effectively. Yep. Okay, so like as long as everyone's like vibing kind of on the same page.
A good DM,
you can play it straight, or you can play it more for like a little bit of comedy.
A good DM will try to reflect the tone that the players create together. Yeah,
it also like can just like on a dime, because of like you can be like really deep in a character moment or like an RP moment that is like serious and somber, and then like somebody else thinks of a really stupid fucking joke, and it's just, it just comes out because. People just say it, and then you just have a laugh, and then you have to go back into the somber stuff.
Right.
It's actually why I thought this movie was very wise in emphasizing and foregrounding a lot of comedy throughout, because I found that true to my experience. While obviously games, like Lee was just saying, will go in a serious direction, I find them overall to be just a lot of like goofs, gags, and bits that kind of pile up.
So I guess I'm curious, do you, and maybe you, none of you can speak to this, but people who liked D&D, did they respond well to this movie?
As far as I'm aware, yeah.
Okay, I was just curious, like, did anyone watch this and be like, this is too silly, or something?
I mean,
like,
I'm sure
there
were
some people who did, but I'm just curious, like, if there was a consensus.
Some people that we would, maybe call themselves, or that we would call grognards, which are like,
I assume,
D&D boomers.
I was gonna say, yeah.
They would be the ones that are also just, like, grumpy that, you know...
That we can't...
Women can have the same strength score as a male character. Head. Like, that.
Sure. But, like, not all of them. Some people affectionately would call themselves old-timer, like, grognards because they, like, used to play 2E or something.
Sure.
But, like, also, those are the type of people who are maybe more likely to be like, why are drow inherently evil anymore? You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, I know a little, I don't know a lot about D&D, but I do know, I was researching a little bit about, like, changes the games have made throughout the years, just to sort of, like, stay with the times and stuff like that. So, yeah, okay, that's fair. I was just a little curious if like, what players, I guess, of D&D generally strike as far as tone goes? I guess that was just my own question.
I would have
been, and I'm sure there's no real answer to that, because it's dependent upon what you're doing.
Exactly. At least the ones that I know responded very positively to this movie and agreed with me that it does a great job of channeling the feeling of playing that with friends.
It definitely does. Yeah. It's one of those things where, like, I feel like, and I didn't want this to be the case, but I feel like if the movie had ended with, like, the four of them sitting around a table in a basement or something, I would have been like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, like if you end with Michelle Rodriguez and Chris Pine and Justice Smith.
Watching this also made me realize something. Okay. So I actually wonder if is the key to making a successful game basically just identifying what was great, or successful game movie.
Okay, sure.
Just identifying what was great about the game and trying your best to channel that feeling as much as you can. So I feel like we can almost kind of, so, for example, we did have notes about Werewolves Within.
Sure.
But that did successfully channel the vibe of a game of werewolves.
I would say mildly success. I would say some, yeah.
Whereas Prince of Persia absolutely does not foreground the things that made Sands of Time fun, particularly all of the knife time travel hijinks.
Sure,
So, whereas, I think this movie does a great job of identifying what works about D&D, and then I also think it's very wise that it doesn't take itself too seriously, because I feel like if it did go too hard in a serious fantasy direction, already now the barrier is getting higher for entry. Now we have to care about this lore in a way that could be alienating or hard to grasp on the fly. And this movie needs you to kind of just get it and
go. Well, the other thing that this movie does that it can do, I think, because of D&D is like, D&D is just like a framework of rules around which to construct a game. It is not, like, as written. Like, there are... People write settings for D&D, and you can make up your own. This one uses the Forgotten Realms setting, which is, like, Faerun primarily, which is a set in... The movie's set in Faerun.
Mm-hmm.
It has Baldur's Gate. It has Neverwinter. These are, like... And Faerun has been used for a while, and it's, like, the first setting that they talk about mostly in 5e when like the 5e stuff came out. Mm-hmm. And it has, so if you have been playing D&D and you play in this setting, you already know all of these places. If you're a fan, like if you play in Forgotten Realms, you're deeply familiar with the lore of these places. Especially if you play Baldur's Gate, those games like 1 and 2, those came out in like the 90s. Like, you know, those. So like there's a lot of like they didn't have to make up all of this lore. They right. could just they had like a huge there's wikis and wikis of like information about these places and books and source books and source books upon source books for them to like get this lore from. And I'm sure they had wizards help to be like, here's all the stuff about Neverwinter.
Right.
So
it helps that the writers and directors were also players.
Yeah. So they could draw on all this without having to like worry about world building. The world exists.
Sure, yes, that's fair.
My point is more that it makes it more accessible to another.
Yeah, player. I would say I think the movie does a pretty good job of that. It does a pretty good job of explaining what needs to be explained and yeah. knowing what you can infer. Like, for example, you don't need to pause and have someone explain the gelatinous cube, because all you get, you see people in there and you yeah. see someone say it stings when they come out. It's like, I get it. There's a skeleton. You're saying it burns. If you yeah. go in there, you will turn into a skeleton. I get it. I don't need you to stop and explain like what the deal is with this. I think it also it does a pretty good job with like those the panther things.
The displacer beasts.
Yeah, it explains them fairly well without having a character stop and be like, that's a displacer beast. You know that they can project illusions yeah. of themselves, so watch out. You see it happen.
There's definitely one. I wish I remembered what it was. Mm-hmm. There was one moment somewhat early on where I was like, that's a really obvious stopping to explain what that does.
No, there are a few times where I think it does do that, and there's a few times where, for me at least, as someone who's not super familiar with this lore, there were a few times where I had to stop and sort of think like, but wait, what's actually like happening here?
Yeah.
And I think most of those times are times where it doesn't matter what's actually happening. Like, for example, I know the whole when they're on the rug and it turns into like quicksand, I know mm-hmm. that's like a D&D thing. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
But like, I know that's a thing. But again, you don't need Hugh Grant to stop and be like, oh, you've stepped onto my rug of such and such, right, which, yeah. as you know, will suck you into it.
Well, the thing
it.
Is, like, I don't think that's a D&D. I mean, I think that could be...
No, I know.
As a DM, I'm like, that could be Mold Earth, maybe? Or, like, it could be another spell? I don't know.
No, I know. And that also is such, a basic, simple thing to infer that you need not worry about
yeah,
explaining
yeah, yeah.
things. I would say certain things, like, maybe druid shape shifting are beats that you need to stop and explain to the audience, because the audience
yeah.
may not know
and
that
like,
this is a thing the druids do.
Wisely, the game does not concern itself, sorry, the movie does not concern itself with like adhering to D&D as it's played,
mm-hmm.
because that is silly.
Well, because
sure.
then, then battles are going to be glacial.
Right, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Well, and like, how do you cinematically show someone like rolling a dice?
Well, right? No,
rolling
I mean, that's not...
No, I know, I'm not literally yeah. saying that like a character would pull out a d20 and be like, let me see what's going to happen.
What
now.
I'm saying is like, a druid has 2 wild shapes per day,
yes.
right.
and that's it. But does that allow you to have a crazy chase scene where Doric is like shape-shifting from like a mouse to a cat to a hawk to
right.
a deer?
To her
no.
tiefling form to like walk away.
Yeah.
Armor. Yeah. And like, no, and that's clever. And that to me is almost in stark contrast to Prince of Persia, which is so much like, no, you have a finite amount of sand and that sand can only go back 30 seconds. Where it's like, that's stupid and boring. I want you to be able to go back for a longer period
of
time.
It. There's no more sand for the rest of
right.
the
and that's it. We're out of sand. No sand now.
So crazy.
It's like, again, because like if that was something they stuck to, if she was like, well, I already turned into a bug twice today, I'd be like, well,
whereas, which would be lame, right? So
that,
I'm glad.
That unfortunately is like D&D. You will have those times where it's like, unfortunately, as a warlock, I've cast all my spells. I demand we rest.
No, and I agree. And I think, but that's also one of those things where, you know, in the
no,
service, obviously, right, in the service of adaptation, you know that you don't need a scene where
yeah.
the character is like, I have no more magic right now. We have to set up camp and like sit here for a while.
Which, to your point, Lee, is just an example of how the movie is smart about where and to what extent it bends the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Similar with having Doric turn into an owlbear. You can't really do that in the game, but it's fucking cool. Why not?
Yeah.
I had a question off of that, actually.
For me?
Yeah, you've already answered one.
By the way, I think they did change. They did... I do apologize about this, because I don't want my DM credibility to be questioned on this show.
Uh-oh.
D2024, I believe, has changed owlbear into beast, but
oh.
it previously was a monstrosity, which means that you could not... You can only transform into beast as a moon wild shape druid. So You could not do it in, like, 2014.
But now you can.
5e. But I believe you can now.
I would say also, going off of that, before you ask your question, Chris, there is, like, a little bit of, like, minor... I don't want to say, like, a quibble, because that sounds, like, a little too pedantic or making it too big of a point. Mm-hmm. But the question I was kind of thinking in my head, especially toward the last battle at the end of the movie, was why doesn't she just turn into a much larger dragon and use that...
Because you can't.
Right, no, and I know
not
that,
good
like,
enough.
She, right, I know, that's just yeah. one of those things, I feel like...
Also, dragons are not beasts.
Okay, I feel like that...
They're dragons.
Right, no, that's what I'm saying, but I was saying, like, those things are not explained in the movie, presumably yes. because you don't want someone to stop the action and be like, now, as you know, I can only turn into this set of things, I can't turn into this thing.
Yeah.
And, like, I get it. It is one of those things, though, that as a viewer, as someone who is not super well-versed in D&D, again, it's not enough to make me call it, like, a problem with the plot or to yeah. Keep me out of the movie. But there was a moment at the end where I was like, well, why can't she just turn into something, like, really
it's
fucking
hard.
Big?
It's one of those things that it's like, yeah, that is the hard... That is something that you'd probably make you question. And it's also hard to explain to a non-D&D player in a way that makes sense, where it's like, well, you see, creatures have a type.
Sure.
And a dragon is a dragon. And a raven is a beast.
Right.
Dragon. There's a number of different dragons.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel...
It does not make for a fun movie.
Right, no, I do feel like there's probably a way you can condense that into, like, 3 or 4 lines and just dumb it down significantly.
Yeah.
If you were to just say, like, well, she can't turn into a dragon because, like, that's insane. That's so hard. No one could do
that.
Yeah,
number one, it's a crazy... there's CR... Sorry, creature rating, difficulty.
Challenge rating?
Yeah, challenge rating. Then there's also, like, you know, they can only turn into creatures of a certain CR and a certain creature type. But I think that that translates into, I think the most flavorful, non-awful sounding explanation in a movie could make for why Dora can't transform into a dragon is that it's not a creature of the woods.
Okay, that's fair. Right. It's right. One, like, yeah, and again, I'm not dinging the movie for not going into this because it's not a huge problem. I don't need everything explicitly spelled out. But I do think that's a, and maybe even I missed it. Who's to say? It's yeah. possible. But I do think, like, there are a few minor moments where I wish a little bit of lore had been thrown in to explain some of these things, yeah. or even just, like, made up cinematic reasons for why these things couldn't happen.
Yeah.
But I digress. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, actually, I also answered another question I had.
I'm doing great.
You are. You're doing wonderfully. Do you have any other, like, remaining questions that were, like...
So your question is, do I have a question?
Well, because you've already blown through the other one.
Jesus.
Of just, like, were there any other lingering questions that made it hard for you to access this movie?
No, I think not really.
Where it's sort of revolving around for me is, like, obviously there was going to be a barrier for entry and understanding, but I guess I was just wondering, from an experience of someone who is just not that as well-versed with it, did that feel like it was holding you away from enjoying the movie?
No, I mean... To be fair, and again, this also, I think, falls under not big enough for me to really ding the movie, but enough, like, again, not enough to, like, cause a problem, but enough to make me think, wait, what, is when Doric says that she was born to human parents who, like, didn't want a tiefling child. And it's one of those things where I know a little bit about tieflings. I did not know they could be born to human parents, but I know enough about a tiefling to sort of know that, like, what their deal is, you know? So that is one of those things that, for me, it was confusing because I didn't realize she could be born to a human. But I do wonder, for something like that, for a person who has no sense of what a tiefling is whatsoever, for someone who has no sense of D&D lore,
right.
Like, would aspects of this be confusing to you? Yeah. So I'm probably not the best person to ask, because, like, well, I'm obviously not well-versed in D&D. Mm-hmm. I know a little bit of D&D. And so, you know, I know enough that I can sort of make answers for myself for things like this if I need to. But I think the movie, by and large, does a good job of explaining things to someone who has no sense of what this is. I think the movie does a good job of selling people on what D&D could mm-hmm. be, which I think, because I feel like this is something I'm sure we'll talk more about whenever we talk about the D&D movie 2 weeks from now.
Yeah.
But it feels to me that D&D movie feels like what an average person suspects Dungeons & Dragons is like, which is to say
yeah.
very boring, very straightforward, yeah. just a whole lot of, like, now I have the magic stick that controls dragons. Now I have the other magic stick that controls the other dragons, where you just sit there being like, boy, what the fuck is this even on about? Whereas this one feels more like what the D&D games I'm familiar with actually is like, mm-hmm. where it's a question of, we have a job to do. This is the job. That one, it's more like, there is a job that they're doing in that movie, but it's sort of nebulous and straightforward and kind of basic and boring. This one is more, we have a job to do, but we also have to do X, Y, and Z in order to ensure that this job gets done.
Yeah.
And even as we're planning out how to do this job, things are going wrong. We have to introduce other characters to help us with this. We have to find someone who knows what this thing is. We have to find a way to figure this thing out. And Lee, as you said, the Regé Jean Page character feels like the DM,
yeah.
sort of coming in and being like, all right, we have to, like, keep things moving.
Yeah.
I'm going to play a character who can come in and explain some things to you and help you guys out just to help us get back on track to solve this main problem.
I also just love how he plays that character. I love that all of his dialogue is way more serious and grand and kind of poetic.
But also, like, weirdly awkward and, like,
yes.
He's, like, incapable of, like...
Chill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of understanding how humans speak.
Right, he doesn't understand colloquialisms, he said, so he takes everything at face value.
What does he say? I find irony is a
thing that trade
that cuts the user, wielder, most of all.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, do you find that? Do you find that same? I also love that bit where he was like, you may have forgotten your vows, but your vows have not forgotten you.
He's like, just because the sentence is symmetrical doesn't mean it's not nonsense.
Yeah, so good. I thought especially, like, it would be so easy for this movie in its quest to have the comedy and to try to make it more accessible. There was a way this could have gone that I think is very present in the other D&D movie, where there's almost this, like, contempt and embarrassment for it. So they have to, like, undercut it so fucking hard just so you don't think that they're taking it too seriously. I think especially with the Regé Jean Page's character, it could have gone in that direction, but it didn't. Like, it wasn't breaking it to be like, this whole thing is stupid. It was more just like, this is a really stuffy character. Yeah. And,
well,
for those that are familiar with D&D, that's also very Paladin-esque.
I think it's just like, I think it's also a very fun take on, like, it's the idea of presenting this, like, super serious fantasy character, but also it's just funny because he's, like, too serious for the world around him. Mm-hmm. Like, the world around him is, like, he belongs, like, in a movie that's, like, not this movie.
Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the scenes in this movie that I think are, like, the truest to, like, the sort of player moments in D&D, I just need to shout them out because there's a couple
that
really do. The first one is 100% the first bit where Ed is trying to, like, persuade the council to let them go, and he's, like, really dead set on the, like,
Jonathan
being there, and they're like, everyone's like, why? Like, we don't need Jonathan here to make a judgment or whatever, and he keeps, like, extending his, like, sob story, and, like, the decision comes down, like, the part decision, and then finally this Birdman walks in, and they just, like, abandons everything, just, like, grabs Jonathan to jump out the window, because his whole plan the whole time was just to use Jonathan to, like, soften the blow.
Right, like, if you dive out the window while holding him, he will fly to save himself.
He'll fly and save himself, and then they can, like, run away from there. But as they're jumping out the window, the other, like, the dragonborn guy is just like, we approved your plan!
It's so
stupid.
It's so good.
Which is, like...
a very player thing.
That's 100% something that players will do, like, they'll just interrupt the DM before the DM is about to say something, and they'll be like, okay, well, I'm gonna do this, and the DM's like... okay, I'll let you.
It's especially player-y because it's like they're going through this insanely circuitous, very disruptive plan that turns out to be utterly unnecessary.
Yeah.
Like, it was complicated for nothing.
Like, they passed a skill check and the DM's like, okay, I guess you don't have to take that.
And I love how they call it back at the end.
Yeah.
Where they just bricked the window up so it couldn't happen again.
The second one is the whole speak with dead sequence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where, like, that has literally happened. And, like, that is, number one, an example. That could be an example of both, like, player antics and also DM trolling.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
DMs will absolutely love to do that.
I love that bit. Was that a question?
Yes.
And then just falls back down.
Yes. So basically, just to go into a little bit of detail, they're digging up multiple people because the first person, they end up wasting all their questions inadvertently by, like, asking questions and the corpse answers them, and then it's like, well, five questions, then dies again. So if you dig up another person, that person tells them they have to find another person. That person's like, no, I'm not this guy. That's my brother. He's another guy, so they have to dig up that guy. It's just a lot of, like, very quick sort of digging up people, realizing that person can only tell you so much,
and then
directing you to another dead person.
And the funny thing about that is, like, he had, like, a magic item, presumably, that lets him do that.
Mm-hmm. It was like a token.
Which I imagine the magic item in a real game would also have charges and probably wouldn't be indefinite use, but that's, like, a third level spell. And, like, for you to fuck that up and or for a DM to troll you with that is just so funny.
Because
that is, like, not an expendable resource you want to be wasting.
It was also, I think, just, like, a genius choice for a comedic sequence.
Yes.
I mean, it still moved the plot along, but I just thought...
The funniest bits were when they had extra questions.
Yes.
And they're just like, what's your favorite food?
Yeah. Do you like cats?
And then some of them are like, I don't know. And it's like,
I love how he goes, oh, what's your favorite book? That was 5 questions, right? And then as he gets to the end, that was only 4.
He's like, whoa, hard to pick just one. It just goes into like a lecture about books.
I would also say, speaking cinematically, I like the sequence where Doric starts off as an insect. It's where she is spying to see what the deal is with the castle and the vault, where she's noticed by Safina and has to escape. So she's transforming into multiple, we kind of alluded to this, but she's transforming into multiple different animals to help her escape, where she goes from like a bug to a mouse to herself to like a falcon to back to herself to a deer. And it's done. It's, you know, obviously it's a fake one shot, but it's a one shot where it's a very well-directed and very good fake Warner, I think. Yeah. It smartly and effectively utilizes her abilities, I think, in a way that I liked a lot. And I think that made the sequence a lot more interesting to sort of just see her going from one to the other. When you think of how you could do that in such a dumb, basic way, where, you know, you feel like the less creative, straightforward way is she's a bird and she's looking in a window and Safina's like, no, that's a tiefling, kill it. Yeah. And then the bird has to like fly away and that's about it. Whereas with this one, there's a lot of shape shifting. There's a lot of like falling into things or through things. And you just kind of follow this character solely the entire time. Yeah. And it's a lot more cinematically interesting. The other one I would say is just the entire sequence of them sneaking the painting onto the wagon, which I think is really good, really well done, really effectively uses, like, you know, the what you know has to happen in this scene and utilizes everyone's ability, effectively complicates things in smart ways, which I think is good too. It doesn't feel like they're just throwing obstacles in there for the excuse of dragging out an action sequence or something like that.
I found the action to be very well directed.
I do too.
Really, really entertaining.
Because I meant to look, like, I don't really, like, I know Jonathan Francis Daly and John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, I combined them into one person because I knew them mostly as writers. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they had directed, and maybe I'm wrong.
I believe.
Okay, they did Vacation, the National Lampoon Vacation reboot, and this. And that's it.
And I think there was something else they were working on.
They're working on something now, it seems like. John Francis Daly. Okay, they did Game Night. They both directed Game Night also, which I have not seen, but I want to
pretty
see.
Pretty good.
Yeah, I've heard that. And they're doing something coming out this year called Mayday for, I guess, Apple TV, it looks like, with Ryan Reynolds. So I'm not holding my breath on that one. But nonetheless, I would say these are two people who have not really directed an action movie before. Everything else that they've done has been a little more grounded or small. And I think they acquit themselves pretty well for two people who haven't really done this kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of impressive, especially, again, I don't want to spend the whole episode doing this, but when you compare it to the 2000 D&D, which is done by a director who hasn't really done shit before either,
right.
It's impressive how bad that is.
Right,
and how,
in comparison especially.
Right, and how fairly, and again, I feel like a big thing to point out for something like this is this movie has a budget, which the 2001 really did not have so much. So I don't want to say that it takes care of everything for you. Having more money covers everything, but it helps
definitely
a lot.
Helps.
Let's be honest. It helps a lot because you can have, if you're having issues with directing, you can have someone else come in and be like, oh, I know how to direct this action sequence just, you know, on the DL basically, or sort of guide you in the right direction or something like that. You know, it's easier to have interesting background creatures, which this one does, as opposed to the other one, when you have the money to actually create these costumes or visual effects like the dragons compared in that one versus this one. It helps a lot to have them look good,
right.
But at the end of the day, if the story doesn't work, it's still not going to be that good of a movie.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Mm. If the 2001 or the 2000 movie had a bigger budget, it still wouldn't have helped things at the end of the day.
No.
It would have helped certain
it would have
creatures
been
look
maybe
more realistic.
More watchable.
Sure, perhaps. But that's an important thing, I think it's important to have for something like this. This one does have the advantage of having a lot of money behind it, which certainly helps.
You were talking for a long time, and I didn't want to interrupt.
Yeah, sorry.
But I did want to add.
Yeah, what other moment?
So far back.
Yeah.
In that wild shape sequence.
Yeah.
I question the deer. That's the one thing I question. They're not the time for a deer.
I would agree.
In the city streets.
The thing I would question also is when she dives out the window, why does she turn into a bird instead of like a bug? Because they start shooting at the bird with arrows. If you were a bug, that's going to be considerably harder to shoot. So I think if you just turned yourself into a bug, they're less likely to shoot an arrow at you.
Maybe there are other weird rules. Maybe they invent new rules about druid, where it's like, I can't be the same thing twice in a row.
Sure, something like
so
that.
So I have
right.
to be, now I got to be a bird.
Right. Now I have to turn into a deer because I was already something else too. Like I can't turn back into a mouse to escape through the grates.
I guess if you also wanted to do a little work for this movie, it would be like, it was a snap decision, perhaps not a wise one.
Sure, sure. But I think it is one of those things that is fun. You can poke holes in it if you choose to poke holes in it. I think
I can't believe she never became a wolf. That's crazy.
That is the route one choice for a lot of movies.
Direwolf is like number one. I'm going to fight as a direwolf.
Yeah, it does feel like rather than a deer at the end, a wolf would have been better because wolves are fast and they also are dangerous. Yeah. So, you know, you got two things going for you.
And they have pack tactics, which means that your allies within 5 feet get advantage on attack.
Well, there you go.
I don't know if there's anything else I really have to say about this movie.
You have some questions for Brendan.
I think I answered them all without knowing because I'm just that fucking good. Yeah, what's up?
Would you, having seen this movie,
yeah.
Would you ever play D&D or a similar RPG ever again?
So here's the thing. I've played D&D once before. It was with all you guys. Yeah. You were there too? Okay, yeah. I know.
Daedra. You were Bedlam.
I was not Daedra. I was Daedra. How dare you?
I don't know who your name was.
I was Daedra the Red, and my opening move was always...
kick to the balls.
Just a kick to the nuts. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I don't know that I would, because to be honest, I think as we've established, most games are not for me. Yeah. And I think the thing with D&D is I don't really have the patience for a lot of it, because campaigns go on for a long time in D&D. And I think I just do not have that level of commitment to something that I could do it, you know, for a couple of hours each week.
Yeah.
I 100% get the appeal. You know, it's something that having played it, it's like, I get why people like this. Not for me, I think. I don't know. Like, theoretically, someday, maybe I would play it again.
There are, like, people do, like, one-shots.
I know, like, the campaigns need not extend on endlessly. Yeah. Like, you can do a one-and-done pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But I think for me, it's just, there are a lot of gameplay mechanics that... You guys were all very helpful because I did not understand. So, like, I'm grateful for you guys for that. But I mean, contrary-wise, the other problem is I don't want to know them.
Yeah.
Because, like, I don't have the patience to learn or understand these things.
The investment is not there.
Right. So it's like, if you guys are okay having someone sitting there who is, like, asking you to, like, tell him what to do in each scenario, then sure. Yeah. I think for me, I find certain things, like the dynamics of battle, to be less interesting than most other aspects of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of the least interesting part of D&D.
There are, like, systems that are more... Like, I would call D&D, like, medium to medium-high crunch.
Mm-hmm.
And, like... But also pretty high on, like, the storytelling. There are systems that are, like, much higher on, like, improv storytelling. Like, just people talking stuff out. And, like, a dice roll every now and then.
Sure.
And the dice roll isn't, like... Like, Fate is a pretty, like, basic... Like, once you have a character, it's like, okay, do a roll. And the roll is like, did you do the thing or not? How good did you do the thing? And that's kind of it. It's like, so there are systems where it's more, like, based on improvisational storytelling with occasional dice to determine if you can do a thing or not.
Mm-hmm.
And systems that are more based on, like, you know, stacking your character with, like, abilities that let you... You have to know them all, and then you have to, like... You have more agency to influence things because of your abilities, but then you have to know all the stuff that you know that you can do. So it's all different, but I think that the, like, the fun aspects of, like, D&D, this is like a D&D movie, and I think it aspects that, but I think the core aspects of, like, TTRPGs in general, for me, is, like, the... sort of group storytelling aspect.
Yeah, and I think this does a very good job of effectively capturing that. This is sort of like a hard and weird thing to describe, but I think one of the things this movie does well is it feels like every character is a mouthpiece for a real person playing this game, if that makes any sense at all.
Yes, it does.
Where, like, you can sort of see... You know, like, it's like you could see, like, the gods pulling the strings of the sky. Like, you could see, like, what the actual people playing these characters might be thinking at any given moment during this movie.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, someone's like, oh, my God, like, we're still doing this shit. Like, I can't believe we're still doing this. We have to keep moving things on.
Yeah.
And then you, like, you know, you have another character who comes in to help explain things.
I can see straight up into Chris Pine's player.
Yeah.
Oh,
as
yeah.
the player of all of those characters who's
for
like,
sure.
guys, we can't just, like, stop and drink all the time. And
right.
We need to, like, make a plan.
Yeah.
Because, like, I am always the character in the party that, like, has the higher intelligence or wisdom score and is just trying to, like, stop the chaos from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas everyone else is, like, the character, like, is, like, somebody playing, like, Holga who's, like, I'm just going to hit people. And I'm
sure.
like, don't just hit people. We talk to them.
I do love her throwing a potato at
Yeah,
that's fun.
At Hugh Grant.
Is there anything good you want to throw out real quick that we hadn't really mentioned?
Just one thing I wanted to point out. I love, they show you a lot of magic. Sometimes they tell you what it is. Sometimes they don't because they don't really have to. But I think it all together looks really good. I just wanted to give a specific shout out to just two spells I thought looked really cool. I love how they do time stop as just like that, like ever expanding bubble. I thought that was a really cool way to visualize it. And I also loved how they, I guess it must have been Greater Illusion or whatever they used for when like Chris Pine's character.
Yeah, it's called Major Image.
Major Image is like approaching them and then starts to like repeat and warp. And,
yeah.
Like, I love when like the face just starts.
Yeah, it's like starts like sinking into his shoulders.
I just love, I thought there was such a lot of creativity in how they visualize these and a lot of playfulness.
Yeah.
Like, Ivar's black tentacles, I love that it was, like, at one point, it gets, like, peeled off his mouth and then, like, snaps right back. Oh, it was good stuff.
Yeah, I think this also, I feel like this ties in with the movie The Sorcerer's Apprentice we did. I think this movie does a good job at visualizing different kinds of magic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in interesting individual ways that you might not always get in something like this. Like, spells look different from each other. You can have a pretty good sense of who is doing what when they're doing a spell. It's not just, you know, I'm shooting magic, like, zaps at you, you know? Like, I'm just shooting, like, a white thing at you and it's hitting you like a laser. Right. So I appreciate that a lot. I love Hugh Grant's performance.
I think he's so funny.
Yeah, as sort of a scamp kind of character. And it's also
scamp villain.
Yeah, because it's I think it's a wise thing because he's not the real villain in the movie.
Yeah.
He's sort of like a doofus who's sort of being propped up by someone who's using him, which I think is one, a wise thing, because it means that in theory, if there were a sequel, you could see a world where Hugh Grant has to join them for some reason and has to like sort of play nicely with them. And two, it also plays to Hugh Grant's strength as kind of being a foppish buffoon as a character actor, which I think he's so good at. It's a lot of fun to see him playing that part in here. It's like Paddington 2 all over again.
I also just wanted to put a shout out that obviously, they use CG all over this movie, but I love how much of it appeared to be practical.
Yeah.
I love.
There's a lot of good practical effects.
I love that, as far as I can tell, Jonathan, the Aarakocra bird person, the cat people, and I believe that the dragonborn guy, I believe those were all practical armatures and costumes and prosthetics. I thought they looked wonderful.
Yeah, that fish, that like that big fish that they're pulling the cat out of is a real fish, or I mean, not a real fish.
A real model.
Right, like a tactical physical object, which I think is great. I love that they put so much focus on that, and I think that's something that really helps it pop.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was there anything you wanted to throw in?
You're talking about magic. Yeah. I really like that the two Bigby's hands are really different.
Yes!
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of like styled differently.
Yeah. Like she has like a clawed, sort of muddy, like looking hand, and he has like one made of the cobblestone
from his It looks like Rice Krispies.
Yeah.
And it sort of forms and unforms times. Something I also realized when we started talking, do you remember back towards the end as Sophina's approaching them and she's like rapidly undeadening? And
sure.
You were kind of just wondering, like, does she realize this is happening?
Yeah.
I actually realized she didn't, because that was when Kira would have slipped
the cuff on her, which
would have shut down the glamour she was wearing.
Ah, interesting. Okay, that's interesting. I didn't think of that at the time, but you're probably right about that.
Yeah, that's a good catch.
Yeah.
But like
my thought was that she was somehow like desiccating and hadn't realized it or something. But she's just turning to her.
Either way, the point is that like this is just how she looks, and
sure.
The way that she appears is always an illusion.
Right. No, it was more just like my question at the time was just, is this intentional or not on her part? And it seems like I thought at first it was, because like when you initially said that like that's how she really looks, I thought like maybe she was just like, well, no need to throw pretenses anymore.
Which is what I thought too.
Right, but no, you're probably right that it was because they slipped the thing on her. That's
magic,
dampening cuff.
Resistance cuff. Yeah.
Is there anything that didn't work for you? I'm just curious.
Not really. I mean, we've already kind of said this, but you can kind of pick apart different moments and find things, but for me, this movie reaches a level of good times and entertainment that I see no real need to scratch it very hard.
Okay. I would have personally said, I don't think the stuff... Is Kira the daughter?
Mm-hmm. Kira.
I don't think the stuff with her works as well as the movie thinks it does, I would say. I have... This is, again, probably a weird quibble that I'm sure can be justified in some way, but it's weird to me that whenever she sees... Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez of being, she goes up to Michelle Rodriguez, immediately hugs her, and then sees Chris Pine is like, oh, like, hey, dad, you're back. I would feel like if he's poisoning her, if Hugh Grant is poisoning her mind against Chris Pine, why not just do it against everyone? Because I would think that, again, if she loves Michelle Rodriguez that much, when Michelle Rodriguez says in the next scene, like, no, it's a resurrection slab. You know, Hugh Grant's lying to you.
That should clear it up.
Right. I feel like, at the very least, there would be some sort of conflict there. So I think it's a little weird that she is so responsive to one of them and not to her dad. I have no problem with her not being responsive to her dad. Mm-hmm. I just think it should be consistent one way or the other. Because overall, I think the daughter relationship between Chris Pine and Kira doesn't really work super well for me.
Yeah.
Emotionally speaking, it's a little bit of an afterthought. It's also one of those things where as soon as they introduce the concept of the resurrection tablet, you as a viewer immediately know mom's not coming back. Whatever happens at the end of this, one way or the other, and it was just a question of, do they use it on Chris Pine? Does someone else end up having to use it?
It just doesn't make mechanical story sense because, yes, she's an important character to Chris Pine, but to the viewing audience, she's maybe only had, like, 2 minutes
of
screen time, and you've spent a lot more time getting to know these other characters.
Sure, so it's almost one of those things where when Michelle Rodriguez dies, it's like, well, obviously, of course you're going
to
use it
you
on
have
her,
to.
And not on your dead wife, which, you know, I get, and I think the movie is certainly trying to do the work to make you understand why Chris Pine would still have, you know, would still sort of, like, be weighing options in his head at that point. But for me, in a world where this is effectively the mother figure for this child, I can't imagine a world where you would make any other choice. Right. And so it's just, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's a little pat. It's a little, it's not quite as engaging or as emotionally resonant as I think the movie wants it to be at some point.
It doesn't hold up as well.
Right. And it's not something that makes the whole movie fall apart by any means, because so much of the movie does work. I think for me, it's just, I wish the stuff with the daughter had been given a little bit more focus, that they had thought a little bit more about it. I can almost see a world where the daughter is not even a part of this movie, where you write her out entirely and it's literally just that they want to get the tablet back so that he can use it on his dead wife, and then they have to use it on Michelle Rodriguez because she's dying anyway. He realizes that his wife has moved on and he needs to use it on this person. So I don't know. I feel like it could have probably been done a little better. I feel like that's my one major ding against the movie, is that I didn't like the daughter stuff that much. I also don't think the kid was that good, but I don't want to ding a child actor because she's a child.
Yeah.
But that would be my one sort of quibble, I think, with it. The one big quibble. Aside from that, I had a good time.
This is minor, but I'm not sure that I think that the sort of Simon's, like, confidence issues or magic weirdness is, like, wealth is, like, I don't know, it didn't quite click for me.
I do agree with you that I think it clears itself up very quickly, where you see him seeing his ancestor and he's like, you suck as a magician, and then
I don't know where that comes from.
Right, exactly, because then, and then you don't see any of that again. You just see Simon around and be like, well, I've tried this 30 times, it's not working. And then at the end, when he puts the helmet back on, he just, like, punches his ancestor and he turns into himself and he's like, aha, the problem was you all along. Spears like, I guess it was.
It's like, it's an interesting, I just think that it's kind of wasted potential more so because what's interesting, so it's weird that he's sort of introduced as, like, a sort of, like, half inept sorcerer, where he's like, oh, he's like, and he's a wild magic, it's briefly mentioned that he's a wild magic sorcerer,
right.
He does wild magic, which means the wild magic archetype sorcerer in D&D is like, every now and then your magic goes wonky.
And something else will happen.
And something unexpected happens that you have no control over.
Sure.
And you literally roll on a D100 table and, like, some shit happens.
Right.
And sometimes it's very good. Sometimes it's very bad.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it's just weird and ineffectual.
Sure.
Like, your hair turns into feathers.
Uh-huh.
Or, so, like, one is you summon a flump who is terrified of you. A flump is a weird tentacle thing.
Uh-huh.
And, like, sometimes a fireball hits you in the face. Then you take the damage of
it,
and also everything around you. So it's, like, an interesting concept to have this, like, sort of sorcerer who's described by people as, like, not that good, who's a wild magic sorcerer who probably has these, like, chaotic tides of magic that occasionally come out. And he's a wizard blood sorcerer, which isn't a specific thing that I know. It probably has been a thing in past editions of D&D. Wild magic is just kind of, like, that's, like, the sorceress tradition, which is just, like, you got magic from something weird.
Sure.
Could be from a wizard. Could be from, like, the Feywild or whatever. And wizards and sorcerers are kind of like this classic, like, frenemy opposites kind of thing, where it's like, wizards study to gain magic, and they had to learn it all by hand, and they had to, like, learn, and they had to memorize the spells, and they have to do it every day, and they have to study. Sorcerers just have magic. They know how to do it intuitively. Like, it's just in their blood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, a very different way of doing magic. And I thought it was an interesting thing for having him to have a connection with, like, Elminster or, like, wizard bloodlines, but to be a sorcerer who casts intuitively, and therefore wouldn't have the sort of, like, book knowledge or maybe deep understanding of what he's doing that a wizard might have, but just sort of is doing stuff instinctively.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not delved, like, that's, like, rich room to develop this sort of confidence issue that's not delved into.
Right.
At all, and instead he just sort of meets this great-grandfather who I think is just another sorcerer.
Yeah.
And it's just like, again, there's sort of these weird half-conversations about him, like, not being good enough or whatever to attune to the thing.
No, that's a good point.
I don't know what, like, it's a lot of stuff they introduce about this character that I don't think is utilized properly and is dealt with, again, too neatly.
Yeah.
Too quickly.
Yeah, that's fair. I would definitely agree with you on that. His character is, I think, a little more underbaked than most of them. And I think it probably helps that, like, Doric has very simple drives for her as a character, where his are a little more confusing because you don't really get why, like, what his deal is really
Holga
as a character.
And Doric are very basic.
Right.
You understand exactly.
Right. And you get what Chris Pine's deal is because, like, he's the main character and he's already explained, like, what's driving him as a character. Yeah. But with Simon, it's a little more confusing. And then the more you find out, the more you're kind of like, wait, that's it? Like, this is your hang up here? Okay. I guess.
Yeah.
No, that's fair. That's valid, I think. I would throw out one last thing that I liked as a good thing about this movie is that there is no romance between Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez, which I think would have been very easy to do. Mm-hmm. And I like instead that they're just sort of a weird family unit unto themselves where, like, they are both the parents of this child, but they're not, like, none of that between them.
No.
Thank you. Which I think is it makes it a much more interesting group dynamic, too.
Also very fun when she goes to visit her ex.
Yes.
And it's a little halfling.
It's Coop.
Played by Bradley Cooper.
Yep, it's a little Coop.
And he clearly has a type because his new girlfriend is even
And she has
bigger.
A type too because she sees a halfling in the end.
And yeah, and it's like, hey there.
She even bites her lip at him.
She bites her lip.
I wonder how that works sexually.
Let's not get into it.
That's for the sequel.
All right.
I mean, I feel like we've kind of reached the end. Did anyone else have anything else they wanted to say about this movie?
No,
not really.
I've said my piece.
Okay, well, can't wait when we come back in 2 weeks to watch the other D&D movie, Stumble and Fall Miles Behind this one. So that'll be in 2 weeks when we'll watch Dungeons and Dragons. Socials, please.
Draftpack.com is the website. That's really all you need to worry about. We're on all the podcasting apps, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, what have you. So you can find us there. Also on the website that I just mentioned, too. Episodes are there as well.
All right. Awesome. And we will buy it out for now.
Bye.